This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. Today, we're talking about foster care in Indiana. A new federal law called the Family First Prevention Services Act aims to reduce the number of children entering foster care by prioritizing family maintenance and reunification. We'll find out more about the philosophy behind that law and what impact it might have on families and children across the state. If you have any questions or comments for the show, let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. We're joined now by Terry Stigdon, Director of the Indiana Department of Child Services. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Terry, can you explain what changes are coming through the Federal Family First Prevention Services Act, specifically around foster care? And actually, maybe before we even get into all those details, what is this act?
Sure. The Family First Prevention Services Act is really a shift in the philosophy in child welfare. What it says is that states need to do a better job of keeping children safe in their home of origin. And if that is not possible, then children should be living with someone that they know, whether that is a family member or kin. And by kin, that can be a neighbor, it can be a coach or a teacher. I've even seen principals stand in as kin or even community leaders that interact with the families. After that, then foster care would be the next option, traditional foster care. And then if foster care is an option, and then there are other options that would be available, such as group homes. So it's to, the purpose of it is to make sure that children are in the safest environment possible where they can thrive, and to make sure that they are in the least restrictive environment.
Mm-hmm. And is this new? I mean, pardon my ignorance on this. My idea of foster care was just, you know, kids get put into the system and then matched up with a family, but this is keeping them sort of in their environment instead of pulling them out.
Yes, that is exactly what it is. I would say that it's not a new philosophy, so to speak, but it isn't necessarily widely used nationwide. So, you are right that traditional foster care, how you understand it, I would say that you understand it at a high level very well. But what Family First aims to do is to say that the child services organizations or child welfare organizations can do a better job of supporting families and keeping children safe at home instead of that quick reaction of removing them first and then trying to figure out how to get them back in the home. Because removal is traumatic for children. So if we can help support a family, wrap around a family, put resources in the home to keep the child in their home, in their own bedroom, around their friends at the same school, then we should do that because children do better when they can be home with their families.
Right. This sounds more like something, you know, the phrase, it takes a village to raise a child. So this sounds like really working together.
Absolutely. That is exactly the phrase that we are looking for. So thank you for that.
Well, I am curious, though, what are these changes now that are happening to this Family First Prevention Services Act?
So there are several changes that states need to do in order to be ready to go live with the Family First. One would be is to connect with community leaders and make sure that their communities are built up in order to support families. Another step that states need to take is to improve the services and supports that we provide to kinship caregivers and relative caregivers, whether that's with rabbit licensing processes or making sure that fundamental needs are met so that they can help take care of the child that is in their home. The difference between kinship caregivers, relative caregivers versus traditional foster care is that relatives and kin, they answer the phone and say yes right away without any preparation to take mm-hmm. care of a child. So the level of support needs to be different. So it's requiring states to really up their game in how we support those relatives and the kinship caregivers. And then if a child needs treatment in a residential facility, there are lots of additional requirements placed on those facilities to make sure that children aren't spending a long time or prolonged time in those facilities to receive that treatment. So it's to make sure that they do need that level of restrictive treatment, that they're in there only for the time that they need that treatment, and that they exit those facilities with the necessary supports in the community to help them adjust back to living in a home setting.
And how has the pandemic had an impact on any of these programs?
So it's been a challenge for everyone, especially last year as everyone figured out how do we connect with families, whether it's remotely or it's in person, how do we make sure we're prepared for that? But we've been moving forward as a state to do everything we can and be ready. Our service providers around the state have been phenomenal in coming alongside us because, you know, it's DCS is the state agency, but we're part of a larger system to serve families. And so while the pandemic did create some barriers and make it a little bit difficult at the beginning, everyone stepped in and adjusted very quickly. We all have the same thought in mind. It's about these kids and their families. So we need to do whatever we can to move forward with this because Family First will really help us improve as a state and how we serve children and families.
Mm-hmm. And how does Indiana compare with adopting this compared to other states?
We, I would say, are in the grand middle with a bulk of states going live with Family First by the end of September. There were a handful of states that were able to go live in 2019. 2020, there were, I don't believe there were any states, there could have been, but I don't believe that there were any states that were able to go live with Family First because of having to adjust during the pandemic. So we're part of the bulk of states going live by the end of this September.
Indiana lawmakers passed a bill in their recent session aimed at improving communication between the Department of Child Services and the General Assembly by implementing annual reports. What effect do you think this might have on the system overall?
Well, no, we should be providing whatever information the General Assembly needs to know. So I don't think it would negatively impact the agency at all. It just gives us an opportunity to inform them as lawmakers so that they know what laws need to be in place to make sure that we're moving in the best direction for children and families.
Mm-hmm. Another bill enacted allows older youth to remain in the foster care system, receiving resources during a state of emergency. What does this mean?
So what that means is that if there is another state of emergency, that me or the person in my position at the time would be able to make the decision to extend the time frame for extended foster care. We have a program called Collaborative Care. If a young person, once they turn 18, wants to remain in extended foster care, while it would look very different than traditional foster care, they can. And they can stay in that program up to the age of 21 and then continue to receive other services through federal dollars called CHAFE services up to the age of 23. During the pandemic, what we did was Governor Holcomb signed an executive order saying that young people in collaborative care did not need to age out at the age of 21. Out of collaborative care. So they could stay in extended foster care through the time of the pandemic, which meant that they still had access to those services that we provide. And those services are, if they're in college, we make sure that those fees are covered so they can attend school. And they also have an independent living specialist that works with them to help them with living independently. If they're working, making sure that they have an apartment, making sure they have access to supplies, and then having those connections, those relationships and support that they would need as a young adult trying to make it in this world.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like there's a lot of different systems in place to help foster children. What about the need for foster families? Is that still a very big need?
We will always have a need for foster families, even though the number of children needing foster care is going down. What I really want the public to understand that it's not about the number of foster families, it's having a good number of the right foster families. You said something earlier about matching children to families. We want to best match children to families that can serve them well, as opposed to saying, this family has an open bed, let's go ahead and fill it. Mm-hmm. So having a good pool of foster families ready to go would really help us match children well with families. I would rather have a foster family waiting to serve a child than to have a child waiting for a family to be able to help them.
Mm-hmm. How do you change the sort of stigma around foster care? I think, you know, whether it's from movies or real life stories that come out, there always seems to be sort of a dark shadow hanging over foster care. How do we remedy that?
Oh, that's a really big question. You know, my dream would be that foster care is seen as a support for families and not a substitute for families. And that would take a really significant shift, not just in Indiana, but I would say around the country. Foster families, they let themselves be vulnerable by opening up their homes to a very unknown situation. And they're prepared as best as possible, but you never know because a child has been traumatized. And helping that child is going to vary depending on the child and their circumstances. And so what I would want foster parents to know to help get rid of that stigma with being a foster parent is that they are the ultimate servants and very appreciated, not only by the agency, but also by families. If we can have foster families connect with the families of the children where they've been removed from, I think that would help shift the beliefs that the families for the children are bad and that foster families are potentially in it for the wrong reasons. Because I can tell you that the people that I talk to, the people that I've met around the state, foster families, families of origin for children, the young children, and then the young adults that have experience in the foster care system. We have to stop the bickering. We have to figure out how to get everybody working together to make make the situation and the lives better for the children. And sometimes, and I would say many times, that means seeing foster families as a support. So it might sound scary, but I think we can do a better job as an agency of helping foster families see that it can be a beautiful long-term relationship where the child only sees people that love the child or children, and not adults bickering over what's best for that child. So it's going to take more than me talking about it. It's going to, I think take the community leaders, being willing to talk about how they can support families differently. We have foster parent advisory boards, and it will be those parents. We have birth parent advisory board, where it will take those parents to be able to speak up and say, this is really what's best for families overall in Indiana. But you're right, there's a stigma associated with anything having to do with the foster care system. And it's going to take us being willing to have those difficult conversations publicly. And to not be too proud to say that we can be better and then to do better.
Well, thank you so much for your time. We really appreciate it. And we'll definitely be keeping an eye on the developments of this new act and how Indiana stands with all of it. Terry Stigdon is director of the Indiana Department of Child Services. We appreciate it. I'm Miriam Sobe. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam. So we're talking today about foster care in Indiana. New changes coming after a federal law was passed and how foster care has been impacted by huge events like the opioid epidemic and the COVID-19 pandemic. If you have any questions or comments for the show today, find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana or leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. With us now, we have two guests, Guinevere Kalal, Director of Foster Care Services at Damar Services, and Renee Larson, who grew up in foster care. Gwen, you work in the realm of foster care. What has your experience been like so far?
Well, I would say that, kind of piggybacking off of Director Stigdon, that we are looking at making, you know, some monumental adjustments and positive adjustments within the field for the youth we serve. So we've certainly had a system that's transcended some challenging times and, you know, really learning from those opportunities and experiences and decreasing, you know, the number of children that are entering the foster care system. So I think there is a big shift to focus on maintaining essential connections for our youth and really making this more of a positive experience to remove that stigma and some of the negative potential impacts that we've seen maybe in the past.
Right. I mean, that's all, I guess, kind of assuming that everything comes together by this fall, I think it is, right, when everything kind of goes into effect?
Yeah, in the end of September.
Mm-hmm. But how has Indiana been doing up until now when it comes to foster care? I mean, is this going to be some magic thing that fixes everything, or is there still a lot of stuff that needs to be tackled?
Oh, I'm sure. I mean, it's an always evolving system and opportunities that, you know, we're learning as an industry in a field. So I think we are moving towards a cultural shift. So it will take certainly some time. And as Director Signa mentioned, many, many people to really be involved and have a voice and maybe change some perceptions. So we do have a long way to go, but we have been over the last several years really moving, I believe, from my experience, in a positive direction, making it much more collaborative and focused on the youth and the services and needs mm-hmm. of the youth in care.
So you're saying that, you know, over the years you're seeing more collaboration and communication, whereas probably in the past that wasn't the case.
Yeah, I mean, we understand that it really, like you said, it sort of takes a village, and that, you know, that it rings true. Mm-hmm. So every year, every week, we're moving again and really figuring out how every aspect of a child's life, through educators, through service providers, through, you know, their community members, healthcare, mm-hmm. how everybody can kind of be on the same page to best support that experience of a child in foster care, which, again, may have some negative connotation behind it, but we want to make it as positive and safe, emotionally safe for them as we can.
Right. Now, Renee, you grew up in foster care, and I'm sure your experience is much different as someone who actually lived through this. What was the experience like for you, if you don't mind my asking?
Well, there was some good and there was some sort of not so good circumstances growing up in foster care. I remember having like a team, whether it be like the foster care agency caseworker to the DCS case manager to the foster parent to the courts. And it felt like my voice wasn't being used at all. It felt like everyone was making decisions for me, but I couldn't actually say for myself what is working best for me and what's not working best for me. And so it was frustrating at times, especially as a foster youth, when you're a teenager and you just want to do normal teen things, like trying to get a driver's license or staying after school and but you can't because you have all these appointments and whatnot to go to. So I'm definitely seeing there is an improvement coming mm-hmm. along with that.
Well, it's interesting what you're bringing up, because I think a lot of us don't realize that there are so many things that as a foster youth, you have to, I guess, maybe adhere to or follow, you know, rules and procedures. And I can't imagine how rough that must be, like having so many appointments and things that you have to get done instead of just being able to live your day to day.
Right. And that was just kind of frustrating. Like, I would be embarrassed to tell my friends in school that why the reason why I couldn't attend a choir concert because I was in the choir and I couldn't go to it because, you know, maybe I had a visitation with my mom, or I had to miss school for the first half because I had to go down to the courts for them to discuss my case. And mm-hmm. I was really not wanting to say that because I didn't want to be like an odd person out. Right. And had like a really weird, you know, young adulthood, so to say. So I just kept a lot of it to myself and kept a lot of it private. I did a lot of journaling too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that sounds very tough to have to experience, especially as youth. You know, you definitely want to fit in, and anything that makes you feel different can sometimes feel really alienating. Gwen, on that note, I mean, have there been any changes to that kind of process to ensure that youth don't have to miss out on so many things just to fulfill appointments?
Yeah, there has been. I mean, we have really come a long way in recognizing exactly what Renee was saying about her experience, that we want to make this as quote unquote a normal experience for youth in foster care as it possibly can be, you know, considering all of the, you know, various quote unquote restrictions. So some of those restrictions have been removed and giving them opportunities to have more voice, to participate in more normal activities as their peers would. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I think we are moving in the positive direction. there are still some things, you know, where, you know, children and youth need to attend court or meetings and have, you know, service providers or case managers. So whatever we can do to make that as comfortable for the youth, the child or youth, and least restrictive or least embarrassing as possible, we certainly try to do that. And then any opportunity for them to have voice in their case is, I mean, it's paramount.
Mm-hmm. And Gwen, we spoke with the DCS director earlier about the Family First Prevention Services Act. Are these changes going to impact you and the work that you do?
They will. We are likely going to see, and it's actually, you know, kind of happening as we're speaking, but really the plan is for our families, our foster families that we serve and license and work with, likely to care for maybe an older, be expected to care for an older youth, maybe a youth with a higher level of need. And then why I see one of the biggest impacts and opportunities for us is that collaborative piece and helping my foster families really try to build relationships and supportive partnerships with biological families so that we can decrease the length of stay for foster youth and have opportunities to reunify sooner with their families.
Mm-hmm. And Renee, I do want to talk a little bit more about your story and your experiences. You know, there's often a stigma about foster care. And I'm curious, did you feel anything related to these stigmas through your experience, or do you think it's overly stereotyped?
I did feel some kind of way with the stigma going on with foster care, because back then a lot of people weren't talking about it and it was such a taboo topic. But now I think with shows like This Is Us that have the foster component into the storyline, I think it's starting to make a swing towards a positive side. Whenever you say foster care, they're thinking, oh, that child has a problem, or that child is bad, or, you know, the foster parents, they're just in it for the money. And I've actually seen several friends who are foster parents now, and that they really are genuine about caring for the support for the child or children with that. And there has been some improvements from when I was in foster care about, I would say about 15, 16 years ago. Mm-hmm. So definitely there has been some positive things for that.
Right. You know, I think one of the misconceptions that a lot of people have is that, as you mentioned, foster parents are in it for the money, or they're not a good match for children. Was that your experience at all? I mean, I'm just curious from your firsthand experience, was it not at all what people have portrayed it as?
In some of the foster homes that I was in, I could say that it was in it for the money perspective, and then that the foster parent was just a single parent. It wasn't like a two-parent household. It was just a one-adult household. I think that's probably why I was kind of, I guess, quote-unquote, crazy and just feeling frustrated, because when you have a foster parent and then you have, like, 9 other children that are, like, super young than you, you feel left out and you just feel like no one's paying attention to you and you're just another case number.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, children can often pick up on their environment and the things around them. And Gwen, on that note, I'm curious, you know, we often hear that the foster care system is so complicated to navigate. Many families that could be a great resource in welcoming children into their homes don't even apply because of the process. How hard is it?
Well, and real quick to jump into, I mean, based on Renee's response, there certainly has been some recognition and changes within our system to really amplify the level of, understanding that foster parents have as they go through, and really us working with them to make sure that we're vetting, you know, the most qualified individuals. The process itself, I mean, absolutely a foster parent or foster family that is looking to go through the process, it is an investment of time. And certainly a commitment to the upfront process, as well as once they're matched with caring for children for however long of a tenure of fostering that they hold. So I would say, you know, it's usually about a 3 to 6 month process. And as an agency, we take you through, you know, every step of that. But we do look at your, you know, your background, your financial stability, so that we don't have individuals who may depend on the per diem reimbursement for that. So you have to be financially stable, have a, you know, a clear criminal history background. And again, the investment of time and going through the home study process. So being open and honest with your agency. So, you know, we tell our foster families as they're going through the process, I mean, really kind of consider us, you know, we're collaborating with you, but we almost become a part of your family, because we're going to take you through the process and learn a lot about you, but we're also going to, you know, be a part of your family once you are licensed and have children in your care. So we work very closely with individuals. So it can be, you know, somewhat of a daunting process, but it's, you know, you have supportive individuals and agencies that take you through that and walk you through it and give you the time to do it where it makes sense for you and your family.
Well, the Family First Prevention Services Act make it easier in some way to apply to be a foster family now that there's an emphasis on letting kin and people in the child's community open their homes? Or is there still going to be this application process they would also have to go through?
Well, there still will be, and I can only really speak for my agency as an organization. We do license, you know, traditional foster homes, but also we do work with relatives and kinship providers who become licensed. So it looks like we have the opportunity in collaboration with the Department of Child Services to maybe fast track licensing some of those relative families or kinship homes, so that, you know, these are children who are already waiting and ready to be transitioned mm-hmm. into someone, you know, with someone they know. So we may have more opportunities to do that. But otherwise, I don't think Families First will really impact kind of the traditional foster homes. I think it will look very similar as far as the pre-licensing process.
Mm-hmm. Now, Renee, there have been discussions on how aging out of foster care can be harmful for youth, that once an individual hits the age of 18, they're expected to have life figured out and be able to support themselves. What was your experience like?
Oh, well, I did not have life figured out, that's for sure, at 18. In fact, I was actually still a senior in high school mm-hmm. at 18. So I was definitely not ready to be out on my own. And, you know, I think that's another negative stigma. It's like, once you hit that magic number of 18, I was given a binder and said, hey, have a nice life. Congratulations on turning 18. Have a nice life. I was able to still stay in the system until that summer when I was getting ready to go off to college, and I was actually staying at my aunt's house, by the way, who had helped me get out of the system. Shout out to my aunt at system, by the way. But I was not ready about, I had no idea how to do money management. That was hard. Budgeting. What was that? I was just told, hey, you got a paycheck, go ahead and spend it. Like, I wasn't taught any of that. I also didn't have my driver's license at the time because of the liability issues of being in foster care. Did the foster parent want to put me on a liability claim if I were to get in a car accident? Just the basic things that you would think most people would understand at 18, but didn't.
Right. It sounds like it's a combination of needing resources in the foster system, but also perhaps in high school. Maybe they can kind of teach everyone those skills. You know.
Yeah.
Were you provided any resources or support at the time, aside from your aunt?
I did have some resources. It was very limited. But when I actually was aged out of foster care and I was in college, actually, there was United Way had came up with this initiative called Connected by 25. in which former foster youth that had age out of the system could get housing help, employment help, education help, and they would be, and also continue to be on Medicaid up until they turn 25, because there's just so much stuff that we're trying to do as young adults, and we want to either go to school, go into the workforce, or even go into the military. And then coming back, you're like, well, what do I do? Where do I stay at? You know, what's good credit versus bad credit? And I didn't have I did not know any of that stuff until Opportunity Passport came along, and I was able to get kind of a beginning look of the financial landscape on what's good credit, what's bad credit, what do I look forward to purchasing a car or getting a used car or an apartment info, mm-hmm. and I didn't have that. And luckily they have that now.
Well, we'll definitely touch up on that when we come back after a quick break. We're talking about the foster care system in Indiana. If you have any questions or comments for our guests today, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Sobe. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. Now to our discussion on the foster care system in Indiana. And as always, we would love to hear your questions and comments. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at All in Indiana, or leave us a short voicemail with your first name and where you're calling from at 866-476-3881. We're back now again with Guinevere Kalal, Director of Foster Care Services at Damar Services, and Renee Larson, who grew up in foster care. Gwen, before the break, we were talking a little bit about aging out of the foster care system and some of the challenges faced. What are some of the biggest challenges folks face as they become independent?
Well, I would like to kind of piggyback off of that. And you know, Director Stigden mentioned a program called Collaborative Care, as well as the extension of age of youth and young adults that can remain, you know, in care until they're ready to move more towards independence. So between the collaborative care program and then just a focus on, you know, my case managers spend time working with the youth in our foster homes, trying to develop some of those independent living skills, even from a young age. So Renee mentioned, you know, budgeting and the understanding of finances or obtaining a driver's license. So we really try to put an emphasis on developing some of those basic living skills and understanding at a much earlier age so that, you know, they're hopefully a little bit more prepared as young adults transitioning into the world. But I think there are, you know, some continued challenges with that. And, you know, Renee mentioned, well, if I go somewhere to college, or if I, you know, go to a vocational program or the military, where do I go when I come back, you know, maybe on holidays or breaks? So having supportive individuals and even former foster parents that are willing to remain as a lifelong or, you know, ongoing support for that youth is tremendous. So that young adults have some, you know, that stability and grounding when they're trying to get on their feet.
Right.
Yeah, I was going to say, too, especially when the COVID pandemic first started to break and a lot of the college kids, they would have to leave their dorms. And then they're out pretty much where I have nowhere else to go because my schools got shut down and I have nowhere to go to for like a home base. And the campus is telling me I can't stay in my campus apartment. So you're just kind of like out there and you don't have that support, like unless like if you have like a friend or if you still stay in touch with that foster parent or that foster family after high school.
Mm-hmm. And it seems like the pandemic really highlighted a lot of these things that we probably never would have thought of otherwise. And so, Gwen, have there been talks of improving things in that area? I'm just curious, like with how the pandemic hit and how it must have had a ripple effect on things.
Yeah, I'm not sure how much I could necessarily speak to the older youth or young adult population, since the majority of of our work is supporting kids and children while they are placed with foster families. But they're, in so many regards, I mean, we learned a lot of different opportunities and positive opportunities that came out of the pandemic, but also some pretty significant, you know, challenges. And I was just amazed at seeing foster families. If I mean, I already think that they're, you know, pretty heroic as it is, but to see them really step up and now become full-time, you know, teachers, daycare providers, and not only to their own children and families, but to the children in their care, you know, in foster home placement, and families willing to take in additional children during their separations with their biological families. So, you know, again, I don't know how much I can speak to how that impacted the young adult community and former foster youth, but, you know, I think we learned a lot from that.
Right. Well, I mean, on the note of just of foster care in general, I mean, how did the pandemic hit that realm? I'm thinking it must have been really challenging with lockdowns and stay-at-home orders. I mean, how did that impact your work? Was it really challenging?
Well, it was. I mean, it really adjusted the way that we needed to stay in contact with our families, with our foster families, with our youth, making sure that everyone from the adults to the children were not only physically safe, but, you know, emotionally safe and mentally safe during that time. And, you know, we made multiple adjustments in that regard. But again, I saw, you know, so many families really step up during that time. But yeah, it certainly took a toll on some families when all of a sudden they are expected to be everything in every capacity. So my team, my organization did everything that we possibly could, you know, to support our kids in care, to support our foster families as best we could. Mm-hmm. With the limited availability to be in face-to-face contact with them.
Right. I know a lot of organizations, different entities, the pandemic gave them a chance to sort of pause and reflect and see things from different perspectives. Did you implement any changes? Like, for example, were you able to do sort of like video conferencing and things that maybe you never would have thought to do before?
We did. And so we are a partner provider with the Department of Child Services, and they did allow us, just again, for the health and safety of everyone, as we were learning to better understand what the pandemic was all about. They offered us the opportunity to provide, virtual visits with our families. And it actually allowed us opportunities to engage with our families more, because we, you know, would typically be out to the home once a week or in the child's school. So we couldn't obviously do that. So we actually increased our number of contacts with our families, you know, doing FaceTime and Zoom and different opportunities, and even like playing games with the kids or helping out with some of the homework, just to give the foster parents a few minutes break. Mm-hmm. So we would spend time with the kids virtually, but there is nothing like a face-to-face, you know, visit, but we certainly made do and did learn that was feasible and could be done for a limited, you know, period of time, just again, to maintain everyone's safety.
Right. I want to talk about the pandemic and a bit about the opioid crisis, but I do want to get back to you, Renee. You testified at the State House a couple years ago to talk about education. What was the message you were hoping lawmakers would get from your testimony?
Well, I was hoping that there can be more initiatives on getting more foster youth to know about places to go for education and also resources for education. I feel that at the time that I was going to college, I did not know about the Indiana ETV or the Chafee funds, and also like scholarships that were made for foster youth. I remember reading a report, I think like 64% of like foster youth go to college. They start college. And then the number was pretty low if they completed like an associate's degree, a 2-year degree, and then even lower if they wanted to go for a full-on bachelor's 4-year degree, and simply even lower than that if they want to go on to master. So just putting those initiatives and programs out there that, yes, foster youth does have a chance and that they can succeed and they don't have to be a statistic. When I mean statistic, meaning that they don't have to be a welfare baby mama or going to jail. And that was written about me too, that I would not even make it to college, let alone graduate from high school. As a matter of fact, when I was getting the 21st Century Scholars Scholarship, normally that you would have to sign up back in middle school, so 7th and 8th grade. Well, I didn't know about 21st Century Scholars until the week before I graduated high school. And that was a process, trying to get it waived and trying to make sure that I had the 21st Century Scholarship that August so I can go to school. Mm-hmm. And that was just, you know, better communication, I think, was needed to be there. And with that, I believe that foster youth that are in high school, they can still sign up to be a 21st Century Scholar. And I think, mm-hmm, it's also for every other student too, whether if you're in foster care or not.
Right. I mean, it sounds overall like there's a consistent sort of lack of communication and information for whatever reason it is. And that, from what my understanding is, the more we can see examples and have communication and information at all levels, from schools to foster families all over, this would be a lot more helpful.
Yeah, definitely. And then also definitely too, with just basic skills. Like, luckily I had an aunt that was there, but when you're on a college campus, usually those like first welcome weeks, all the banks are going to like, a lot of the banks are going to be like on the campus courtyards offering, hey, you're an adult, sign up for this credit card, or hey, you qualify for a car, sign up for this car and take out this loan. And you have no idea what you're getting yourself into. You have no idea that even though your credit score is not that great, why are you signing this? And why are you getting yourself into this predicament of trouble when you graduate? Because you still have that debt that's going to be against you.
Right, right. And Gwen, getting back to sort of the pandemic and then also the opioid crisis, these have had impacts on so many families. What impact did you see here in Indiana on the foster care system?
I mean, going back to 2017, we certainly did see an increase in children being separated from their families of origin. And I think in general that whole time took a toll, for lack of a better term, on, you know, the substance abuse community and the mental health service community. So I think in the last couple of years, and since 2017, I mean, the numbers of children being separated from their families really have trended down. And, you know, we're at a much lower rate of separation and placement in foster care today than we were in 2017. So certainly there was an impact, and we saw potentially more children coming into care with maybe some higher medical need. But again, those needs of children are trending down, at least in the numbers of children needing that type of support. So I think we're at a much better place, and a systematic, you know, from the healthcare industry to the mental health and substance abuse and child welfare, the education system, I think everybody has a much better grasp on that. So yeah, we're in a much more positive place than we were a few years back.
And how important, I know we mentioned a little bit earlier about this new act and keeping families intact. How important is that in the long run to really push for families of origin with foster care children?
To me, I mean, this is a tremendous opportunity for not only us within, you know, working within the child welfare system, but for you know, I mentioned it earlier, for educators, healthcare providers, community, people in the community on every level, just to gain a much better understanding of the importance of trying to keep children with their families, as close to their communities, if they need to, you know, have a separation and placement into foster care, keeping them in their families and finding their essential connections and giving them opportunities to participate in, again, more normal activities along with their peers. And I just think it is Families First is really allowing us to move in a much more positive direction and just really focus on that collaboration, that partnership, changing our verbiage and our understanding about the system, because ultimately that provides much better outcomes and positive experiences for children and youth who do it to some extent experience trauma. But how can we make it as safe, emotionally safe, physically safe, and stable for them until they can reunify or transition to the next phase of adulthood?
Right. And Renee, from your experience, how important is this family preservation? And do you feel that this act is going in the right direction?
I feel that it's going in the right direction, especially if the youth or the child has a willing family member, like a grandparent or an aunt, that can come up before they be placed in foster care. That would be a great way to kind of keep the family together. I know one of the issues I remember when I was in foster care was just trying to keep siblings together in the same foster home instead of having to split them apart. If this means to keep that family dynamic, that bio family dynamic, I think it'll be a great start.
And Gwen, what's next for Damar and in this realm of foster work?
Well, as I mentioned, I mean, with the impact and transition towards us being in line with the department to meet the federal guidelines of Families First, we are, you know, really focusing on always, you know, recruiting and trying to educate the community on the need for foster families, because there always will be that need. You know, and so we're working to amplify our training of maybe some of the future needs of our foster youth, just always focused on our collaborative efforts and support of our foster families. I mean, at the end of the day, they are the ones, you know, 24/7 responsible for the care and well-being of the children and youth with them. So focused on increasing our training opportunities and development opportunities for our families and for our staff as well, so that we're, you know, best prepared to meet maybe a higher level of need for our youth and children.
Well, thank you so much, both of you, for joining us this afternoon. I really appreciate your time and sharing your insight with us. Guinevere Kalal, Director of Foster Care Services at Damar Services, and Renee Larson, who grew up in foster care. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can find it anywhere you get your podcasts. Join us tomorrow as we learn about a new center for LGBTQ youth in Indiana, plus how to have tough conversations and why we tend to avoid them. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at All in Indiana. I'm Miriam Soap. Thanks for listening. This is All In.